Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 117 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling It Could Be Worse, It's Not the 1980s, about a presentation that Randy Fortenberry, who holds the Thomas B. Mick Chair in Economics at Washington State University, gave during Spokane Farm Forum held February 6th at the Spokane Convention Center. I trust that by now everybody knows who Randy Fortenberry is. I've featured his presentations in several podcasts from various venues over the last couple of years, the last time in episode 102. I also did a fun interview with him from his WSU office in episodes 79 and 80. You can access those earlier podcasts from the Washington Grain Commission website at wagrains.org. Go to the bottom of the page, click on summaries, and navigate back into time. An early philosopher once suggested calling economics the dismal science, which is amusing because there's nothing dismal about listening to Fortenberry riff on what drives agricultural markets here and abroad. His presentations are the economist equivalent of watching a juggler. And boy, that Fortenberry can talk. And he does it without a single note, although his PowerPoint slides do help him stay on track. Speaking of PowerPoint slides, this is the rare occasion when I'm going to suggest that you make an effort to look at the photographs I took of some of his PowerPoint slides that I'm posting on the Washington Grain Commission Facebook page. Yes, you can get the gist of what Fortenberry is saying without them, but there's value in seeing where we were versus where we are now. And that's where his slides excel. Any farmer will tell you where we are now isn't that great, financially speaking, but as Fortenberry made clear during his introduction, things are not as bad as they were in the 1980s. I want my listeners to know that I wouldn't keep featuring Fortenberry in these podcasts if he was saying the same thing over and over again. But he isn't. And thanks to my superb editing skills, I'm able to include only his best bits. Not that he has any poor bits, of course. I had to be especially adept at editing Fortenberry's Farm Forum presentation because this is the first time I have limited him to a single episode. He opened his speech on some positive notes, pointing out that total farm assets are up and equity on the farm is better now than it was in the 1980s. Non-real estate debt is also lower than it was in the 1980s, though debt on farm ground is up. Fortenberry's not particularly worried about that, as he believes much of the ground that has been purchased is being worked by farmers rather than institutional investors. And of course, interest rates are not as high as they were in the 1980s. Anybody remember 20%? And then, after all that buildup, Fortenberry dropped the other shoe.
Here's the bad news. Farm income is actually significantly lower than it was in the 2014, 2013, 2015 period. You might remember just in Washington, for example, in the summer of 2012, we had $9 wheat in July and early August, so going into the harvest season. We have been nowhere near that since that time period, and income has reflected that. This is a pretty big hit on farm income. Now, this is actually not inflation-adjusted. This is what's called nominal dollars. If I adjusted this for inflation, we'd actually be lower now than we were back in the 1990s and late 1980s. So that drop that you see is pretty significant. The reason I didn't adjust it for inflation is I really want you just to notice what's happened just in the last 4 or 5 years in terms of nominal dollars. And this is a bit troubling. What's happened is commodity prices generally have been lower than they were in 2012, 13, and 14. And costs have gone up. The difference in these two lines, net farm cash income and net farm income, you think about net farm cash income as sort of your annual money coming in and money going out. So you write a check for seed, you receive a check when you sell wheat. The net farm income, not the cash, the lower line, accounts for things like depreciation on equipment. So you start taking these long-term costs into account, it lowers the actual income, but it's not really a cash flow situation. That's really what the top one shows. But they're both going in the same direction. They're down pretty significantly. The only positive sign in this is If you go back a year ago, USDA actually had a lower projection for 2018 income. In other words, we did a little bit better than they thought we were going to do. So what's happened? Well, here's receipts on the crop side. And you can see that for most crops, the receipts, so the amount received, so this is yield times price, are lower than they were in 2014. Now, they've been flat for a couple of years. If you look at wheat, it's up a little bit relative to last year. Cotton's up just a little bit. Vegetables and melons are the only thing that are down on a year-over-year basis, but even those increases are very tiny. And the thing is, this is just the receipts. When you include the costs went up in 2018 relative to 2017. That's why net income actually dropped on a year-over-year basis. Here's livestock, same thing. Better prices in 2014, things have slipped a bit. Now, this is a little bit misleading, especially on the beef side, because the beef market has done really well. We have record, near record, supplies of beef, and we have had very high beef prices. And what's really driven that, which is a bit surprising maybe, is the export market. So despite all the trade turmoil and the impact it's had on the crop side of things, we've actually done very well exporting meat products, not just beef, but also pork and poultry. But even then, if you look at those numbers, except for hogs, most prices are lower than they were a year or so ago. What drives the revenue decline? It's almost all price. So the red bar below the zero line here is the change in price year over year across the whole range of major commodities. And then the first green bar, that 6.8, is the increase in production. So if you increase production, but you have a lower price, you can have a slight increase in total revenue generated. But again, that's not an increase in farm income if costs have gone up at the same time. That little 0.8, that's sort of the price and quantity of really minor crops. So think about things like ginseng, mint, millet, things that aren't produced in really large volume, but they do contribute a little bit to the overall U.S. farm balance sheet. If you take that out, then the real increase in cash receipts is more like 1.8%, not the 2.5% or the 2.5% that's shown on the chart. Here's what's happened to costs. This is where our challenge really has been lately. So this is both nominal and real. So one bar shows what happens if we adjust it for inflation. Every dollar buys the same amount in every year as it would buy in a different year. And then the nominal, which is sort of the dollars you see as you price out of inputs. And we had, for a couple years, a decline, which was nice, but then in 2018, we saw an increase in cost of production. And here's primarily where the increases were. It was everything except seed for a crop farmer, right, and fertilizer. Everything else had an significant increase in costs, including interest rates. So those short-term debts, the production loans, are now facing higher interest costs than they were before. Some of the land debts aren't because they were fixed, but if you're buying land today relative to 18 months ago, you're going to have a higher mortgage rate on that property as well, and that's going to increase overall production costs as you move forward. What does that have to do with trade? Well, the thing is, all of those numbers, the decline in national farm income, the increase in cost of production for most commodities and agricultural producers, all of that was happening in the context of trade debate, but the real trade impacts didn't hit us until August, July or August. So while there was a lot of concern about what was going to happen in trade, there wasn't really a lot of trade friction until more recently. And so those forecast numbers were happening in the absence of trade problems. But trade problems will exacerbate that. If we continue to have significant uncertainty in terms of what our trade opportunities are going to be this coming year, then we might see a significant decline on farm income as a result of prices negatively responding to market opportunities that won't exist if we don't straighten things out in terms of trade. If you think about what's going on in our trade situation, we have, I'm going to argue, probably the most aggressive trade realignment program since maybe the 1920s. And what I mean by that is, we're addressing every one of our trading partners simultaneously. We haven't done that in decades. So we're dealing with the EU, and we have tariffs and counter-tariffs with the EU between different kinds of traded products. Of course, China's the one we keep reading about. It's a huge deal. But we're also In the situation where we pulled out of TPP a year ago, but it went forward with the other 11 countries, and so now, potentially, when we look forward 6 or 7 or 8 months, we might be at a competitive disadvantage to export competitors like Canada and Australia, who will have preferential treatment going into some of our large markets like Japan, and our growth markets like Vietnam. So Vietnam's not a huge market for us traditionally for most commodities, but it is a growing market, and it's one where we thought we had a lot of potential just 7 or 8 months ago. So how this resolves itself will have a lot to say about what really does happen in 2019 and 2020. The whole trade environment is being structured based on the administration's perspective that we've actually been taken advantage of in most of our trading arrangements over the last 30 or 40 years. Okay, you might remember when President Trump was running, campaigning, he said NAFTA was the worst trade deal ever negotiated. And one of the first things he did was enter into negotiations with Canada and Mexico to renegotiate the trade arrangement. He resolved that, except it's got to be ratified by Congress, and that hasn't been taken up yet. So until the House and the Senate vote to ratify the trade deal that President Trump has signed with the Premier of Canada and the President of Mexico, that trade deal is still sort of on hold. That's important to us because, not only in ag, but in general, Canada is our largest trading partner, but both Mexico and Canada are big buyers of much of our agricultural production as well. It really matters what happens in those two countries. Until very recently, what's been interesting is this idea that we really have been taken advantage of and we need to renegotiate with everybody simultaneously was really supported by a lot of people that in the past were free trade advocates. If you think back to the original NAFTA, that actually was signed by the first President Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush. It didn't get ratified by Congress until Clinton was in his first year of president, but it actually was negotiated by Bush, and it was supported by a majority of Republicans in the House and the Senate and a lot of Democrats in the House and the Senate. It was a bipartisan trade bill that was passed with strong congressional support and both a president from the Republican side and then a president from the Democrat side pushing it. They both supported it. If you think back to the last campaign, both presidential candidates, both major candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, both were against TPP and both were criticizing NAFTA. So we had a change in our perception, broad perception, of what trade should look like and what trade was actually doing for us in the short run. Much of the focus that we read about lately, the last 2 or 3 months, has been on China. But that's actually, for us in agriculture, in the Pacific Northwest, maybe less important than some of the other trade partners that we're also trying to negotiate with simultaneously. It really matters. China matters for a lot of product, but less for us in the Pacific Northwest. They do buy a lot of our cherries. That's really important. They buy some apples. They buy about 5%, or have historically, over the last 5 or 6 years, of all U.S. wheat produced, but they're not our biggest wheat buyer. They do buy a lot of soybeans. They buy like 85% of the sorghum that's produced in the U.S. So for parts of the U.S., the agricultural producers are very reliant on China, but it's a little bit less true here. A big thing for us is TPP. So again, both candidates in 2016 argued that we should pull out of the TPP arrangement that had been negotiated by Obama. And on the second day in office, President Trump did exactly that. It went ahead and went forward with the other 11 countries, was ratified in December, and is in the process of going into place now. And what it basically does for us is, if we don't negotiate an attractive bipartisan trade arrangement with some of the other buying countries, so think about Japan, for example, a very important customer of ours, then we can be at a competitive disadvantage relative to, say, Australia or Canada, who are be shipping some of their beef, wheat, and other products into Japan. Now, that doesn't mean it will happen. So, for example, if we had a commodity, think soft white wheat, that is very unique and can't be replaced by some product grown somewhere else in the world, we might still get attractive tariff treatment because the customer in Japan really wants it. But that's an if. That may not happen if somebody finds a substitute or figures out a way around serving the products that a Japanese consumer wants without putting soft white wheat in it. For things like beef, it's a much larger challenge because our beef isn't as unique as beef grown in other parts of the world. And so we can lose export share to Japan in the presence of an active TPP that we're not part of if we don't have a bilateral agreement with Japan. Right now, Japan has agreed to negotiate with us, but there's no timeline. So any positive benefits that may come out of a bilateral trade agreement could be years down the road if, in fact, we take a while to sort of get to the negotiating table, come to terms, and then finally get something ratified. Anything that is ratified has to be authorized by Congress also. And in the current political environment, you can imagine we might have some political challenges depending on which side of a trade agreement individual party partisans are landing on. One of the things that is interesting right now is there's starting to be some pushback, even from Republicans, against the administration's use of tariffs. The argument is, well, Congress really should be responsible for trade, and there's some belief that maybe the administration's gone a little too far in terms of its exercise of trade reducing policies. And in fact, there's a bill that just was introduced into the Senate last week, it's bipartisan, that would try to restrict the additional implementation of tariffs as we go forward. NAFTA. This is a huge deal because we were told it was the worst trade deal ever. We're told the new one is an excellent trade deal, but again, until it actually gets ratified by Congress, it doesn't go forward. And the president has suggested that if Congress doesn't ratify it, he's going to pull out of NAFTA completely. That would be a bad thing for agriculture. It might not be bad for every sector of the U.S. economy, but Mexico and Canada are really important trading partners for us on the ag side. The real picture, though, is we're talking about tariffs that we've assigned to almost all of our trading partners for some products. They've all retaliated, and when they retaliate, they go after the products that we export more than we import, and that tends to be agriculture and actually aeronautics, so airplanes. So that's the two places we've seen significant retaliation. Here's what drove the president's perception that things weren't going well in the trade environment. And it's that our trade deficit has really deteriorated. That means we're importing significantly more than we're exporting. And as he looked at this chart, he interpreted that to mean that we were being taken advantage of and we need to renegotiate the rules of trade to try and improve the overall trade environment in the U.S. He has the authority to do that under a couple of different laws. They're all pretty old, from the 60s and from the 70s. And the one that he's used probably most aggressively is the national security issue. So even threatening to put tariffs on automobiles, that was placed under the national security argument. The steel and aluminum tariffs under national security. But that's not the only thing we've done. The very first tariffs that were placed on imports to the U.S. were on washing machines and solar panels, and that was done under number one up there, injury to domestic industries. Both those sectors had lobbied the administration, arguing that imports were coming into the country at below cost of production, and that was putting industries at risk in the U.S., so people that made solar panels, people that manufactured washing machines. So all of these different arguments have been used, but the most common one now has been the national security argument. Here's what's happened to the balance of trade. So that top picture shows what we were looking at when we started to impose the tariffs. Balance of trade was getting increasingly negative. We were importing more than we were exporting. You can see that it started to improve March and April of last year, 2018. It was getting less negative just as we were imposing the tariffs. But look what's happened the last 4 or 5 months. We actually have a larger trade deficit now than we did a year ago before we imposed the tariff. So far, now this is just a short-run argument, so maybe things improve later, but so far we haven't actually changed our balance of payment, our balance of trade in a positive way as a result of this. But on the other hand, we're just now negotiating. So maybe something positive does come out of the negotiation with the Chinese. Maybe we do finally get to the table with the Japanese and there's some improvement in the trade relationships, but at least so far, there's been a pretty significant cost paid by agriculture, and there haven't been benefits generated to the other economic sectors that we thought might happen when the policies were first put in place. Here's the other complicating factor. the value of the dollar. How many Japanese yen does it take to buy a U.S. dollar? How many yuan from China does it take to buy a U.S. dollar? How many euros does it take to buy a U.S. dollar? That affects our ability to export. The more the dollar costs, the more expensive it is for a customer in France to buy a U.S. product, or a customer in Japan to buy a U.S. product. Here's what agriculture looks like. So we'll get to what we actually care about, baby. These are the forecasts last December of what the year-over-year change would be in volume for a bunch of products. So you can see that wheat was supposed to be up like 11%. If you go back to June 1st, the start of the wheat marketing year, USDA was forecasting we'd export 14% more wheat this year than we did a year ago. Okay, but 11%. Everything was going to be up except, what's the one over there, grain sorghum? It was going to be down 51%. But look at wheat. Wheat was the one picture on there where we were supposed to increase exports, and we've actually decreased exports. So originally a 14% increase expected. Last month an 11% increase expected. We're down 11 or 12%. And we're not just down to China. We're down 15% to Mexico, our largest buyer last year. And unless and until the new NAFTA gets ratified, that's not going to change. So by the end of this marketing year, we only have 3 months left, March, April, and May, we're actually going to be maybe exporting less wheat than we did last year, not more. And last year was a relatively low export number, only 900 million bushels. USDA started out this year saying a billion 25 million. As of December, they brought that down to a billion. In January, they didn't give us any numbers because, including weekly export volume, which we can monitor, because the government was shut down. But on Friday, they'll update their balance sheet, and my guess is we'll be looking at less than a billion bushels for exports, and we'll start to see them recognize that it's going to be a negative number, not a positive number, and a lot of that is because of the trade damage. One of the things USDA did was, last fall, Sonny Perdue said, we're going to compensate producers for the trade damage. So they calculated the damage for a lot of commodities. For corn, it was a penny a bushel, so producers got nothing. Okay? For wheat, it was 14 cents a bushel. I'm going to argue that, at least based on my calculations, that's too low a number. But if we take that number and we multiply it by production in 2018, that's what's being used as compensation for the current trade disruption. But here's the problem. First of all, I think the number's too small. But secondly, and Sonny Perdue has made this very clear, this is a one-time deal, 1 year only. The problem with trade disruptions is they last longer than 1 year. If Mexico finds a new supplier of wheat and they're satisfied with the delivery and the quality, then even if we come back and become price competitive by signing the new NAFTA or USMCA, it doesn't mean Mexico comes back and buys from us in the same volume because they've already established a new relationship with somebody else. Okay? You think about buying a truck. You always buy from the Chevy dealer. Suddenly, he or she decides you're a guaranteed customer and they refuse to negotiate the price, and the Ford dealer negotiates a much more attractive price because you're not a customer of theirs and they want you. If you're satisfied with that Ford in a year, you go back to that person the next time maybe, not the original Chevy dealer. The same thing happens in world trade of food products. Once I have a customer that I'm satisfied with, if I like the price and the quality, I'm not going to change just because somebody else who left me earlier decides they want to come back. That's a big challenge long term. For a Washington producer, more importantly, that 14 cents, think 1,000 acres, average yields were something like 77 bushels an acre last year. For somebody with that average yield and that 1,000 bushels, they're talking about a $10,000 payment on a crop that was worth over $470,000. We export 90% of our wheat in Washington. It's unlikely that only 2 or 3% of the value of that crop was affected by the trade disruption. Now, this is a national average, so maybe it's closer. But I think China itself, they only buy 5% of our wheat historically. Just the Chinese effect is about 4 cents a bushel. Okay, and again, Mexico's our biggest client. Japan's a huge client. South Korea's a huge client, although we're not having a trade problem with them right now. But I find it unlikely that the addition to China is only another 10 cents or, you know, one and a half times what the Chinese damage is. So this is probably an underestimate of the actual damage. And certainly for corn, it's probably not a penny a bushel. What's really at risk, this is one reason that it's underestimated also, is all the inventory that farmers had in the summer of 2018. The compensations paid on production, so 1.8 billion bushels. But this year, on June 1st of 2018, farmers carried a lot of wheat in that they owned from previous years. Well, that also was affected by the trade disruption. That's wheat whose value, stored wheat whose value was declining as the price declined in reflection of the trade situation. Now, prices were higher in 2018 to 2017, so when I say declining, I don't mean relative to a year ago. I mean relative to what they would have been if we'd have had full-fledged trade. Okay, higher prices than we saw if we'd had full-fledged trade. So in my estimation, the real cost to farmers wasn't the 1.8 billion bushels they produced, but it's something like 2.1 or 2.2. It's what they had stored plus what they had produced.
There's an expression I used as a younger man when someone asked me how an experience, which I hadn't been overly thrilled with, had turned out. I would say it was better than a stick in the eye. Certainly a 14-cent payment on 1.8 million bushels of wheat is better than a stick in the eye, but it's less than Fortenberry believes Eastern Washington wheat farmers, who market most of their grain overseas, could have expected or indeed deserved. But better times could be ahead. Reports have the U.S. and China close to a trade deal. Perhaps by the time you hear this, one will have already been struck. If so, I'm expecting wheat exports to China will begin anew. Fingers crossed for the farmers out there waiting and hoping for a marketing opportunity in the near future. I hope you've enjoyed episode 117 of Wheat All About It, or what I entitled, It Could Be Worse, It's Not the 1980s. About WSU economist Randy Fortenberry's presentation at Spokane Farm Forum, February 6, 2019. Please join me again next week for a conversation with U.S. Wheat Associates President Vince Peterson, right here on Wheat All About It!
You think we're simple, you think we're not right. Look at your cities and ask yourself who's right. We've got country and you've got crime. We've got green and you've got grime. Let there be no doubt, we have what it takes to till the soil until our back aches. Just give us a break and don't be so rude. We love the work and you love the food.
We feed you.